You're listening to Life in Deep Ellum's podcast.
Good morning, friends. I hope you are doing well on this July 4th weekend. To start us off this morning, I've got an important announcement for you. On Wednesday, July 15th at 7:30 p.m., we are going to be hosting a community-wide Zoom gathering. With cases of coronavirus going up, it is looking like it is going to be some number of months before we are able to resume any kind of in-person gathering. And so we want to get together on the 15th and talk about what our reopening plan is and what we're going to do in the interim. We want to talk about how we're going to stay connected as a community, how we're going to be communicating with you. We'll be giving an update on Life in Deep Ellum's financial status and Mocha's as well. So this is going to be a very important time for our community. Again, that is happening on Wednesday, July 15th at 7:30 p.m. You can register to get the Zoom link via our events page on the website or by checking out the weekly gathering update, the emailed newsletter that you would have received this weekend. So please prioritize this time. We really would love for all of you to be there with us. We've made it a practice over the last several months to take the first few moments together as a community every week to greet each other. It goes in place of our 5 minutes that we have when we're in person together. And we've done some really fun and interesting things over the last several months. And today, even though it is a holiday weekend, I want to shift the tone a little bit. I want to ask you this week in our greeting time to choose a few people that you are genuinely close to at the gathering. And what I want you to text them, to reach out to them, the message I want you to send them is the answer to this question. What are you afraid of? Right now, we're in the middle of a global pandemic. We're addressing issues of racism in a way that we've never addressed in this country. So what are you afraid of in this moment? So think about who you want to reach out to this morning, what you want to share, and when you're ready, get set, be vulnerable. Thank you so much for taking time to be vulnerable in that way this morning, to reflect on what it is, what's the fear, the pain that's been rising in you over this last week or number of weeks. We're continuing in our You Can Do It series, and today we're actually encouraging you to be vulnerable. That is the thing you can do, is be vulnerable. And specifically, we want to encourage you to be vulnerable by engaging in conversations around race and racism. It's an important thing for us to do as a community. And there are two things that happen when we engage vulnerability in this way. One is these kind of conversations require us to reveal ourselves. I love the work of Ibram X. Kendi. He's the author of the book, How to Be Anti-Racist. And he reframes the whole conversation around racism because he gives just two categories. You are either anti-racist or you are racist. In his estimation, there is no not racist category. You are either racist or you are anti-racist. Christian. So what it means to be a Christian, to be anti-racist. And the thing that I love about the anti-racist category is there is a lot of grace in it because it tells us, hey, all of us are going to have racist thoughts and ideas and feelings that rise in us. Being anti-racist doesn't mean we never have those. Being anti-racist means that we are confessional about them. We own that they are in us and that we need God to help us get them out, to get those out of us, to heal from them. So these kind of conversations, They invite us into a brave vulnerability where we get to reveal ourselves as we truly are. To address denial in whatever form it comes around the issue of race and racism and faith. So that's one incredible thing that happens when we have these kind of conversations. The second thing that happens when we have these kind of conversations is it requires us, the vulnerability of this invitation requires us to let in unpleasant truths. It can be unpleasant to hear how deeply racism has impacted our friends of color. Because then we go, oh my gosh, how did I not know? How did I not know that? It can be unpleasant as a person of color to hear how deeply racism has been in the heart of your white friends, your friends who are not black. That can be an unpleasant, uncomfortable truth to have to sit with. Revealing ourselves and letting in unpleasant truth will make us vulnerable, and you can do it. I want you to consider this. Without vulnerability, there is no love. Love necessitates vulnerability. And what did Jesus tell us? By this, all people will know that you are my disciples by how you love one another. Another way of saying that is by how you are vulnerable with one another. On Wednesday night, Joel and I had the opportunity to meet virtually with 11 other members of the gathering, and we practiced this together. We had a conversation around race and racism, and it was vulnerable, and it was holy, and it was full of love. And it was 2 hours long, and I wish this morning I could share it all with you, but I don't have 2 hours. We are going to share a good portion of it with you. And there were 3 questions that we asked, 3 questions that we discussed. Other things came up, but the 3 questions were, why is it important to have these kinds of conversations around race? Why is it important to have these conversations around race? The second question was, what are you afraid of? We asked people to sit with the same question we asked you to sit with this morning. And the final question was, what is giving you hope right now? So I'm going to invite you to sit with our community, to open yourselves. And the message I have for you this morning is you can do this. The kind of vulnerability, the kind of revealing of self, the kind of letting in uncomfortable truths and doing that with people you love, you can do this. So open up your heart and get ready to see some of our people model vulnerability and love in beautiful ways.
Kevin, I would love to hear from you on why you feel like it's important to have these conversations around race.
Well, honestly, this is really the first time in my life that I've had conversations around race because, to be real honest, I've always in the past thought that race relations really wasn't something that concerned me. It was always somebody else's problem. And, you know, there's been a change in my heart over the past month or so, and I have to chalk that up to God making a change in my heart, because all of a sudden I woke up and I realized that, you know what, there's a problem out there, and I've probably been part of the problem all my life. And so it's important for me to have these conversations because, well, we've had these conversations with family and friends, and even in our life group, we've never done that before. I've never done that before. I've never brought up race relations in my family or with my friends, but you know, having these type of conversations with people, it's just brought me to a new level of understanding. And when I say that, I don't mean just understanding of what other people are going through, but I think it's brought me to an understanding of myself. Yeah. And who I am. And, you know, the things that I may have contributed to in the past, whether wittingly or unwittingly, what I've been a part of. And so it's really starting to open my eyes to who I am, what I've been a part of, and where I need to change.
Yeah.
So it's really important to me that we have these conversations right now.
Yeah, Kevin, thank you so much. Yeah. And Preston is in your life group. And so absolutely. I know that you guys have been having this conversation. So Preston, I would love to hear from you.
Thank you, Rachel. And I thank Kevin for being so open and honest about his feelings and being so kind and gracious to bring this to our group. It's very important. I think it's important to have these conversations because it's the way that we as believers can impact the world in this time when so many people have had their hearts and souls touched by something that happened before their eyes, and bring them to a point of understanding that it's a soulful thing. It's your inner character that matters, that makes you feel and care about other people and want to do something about it. It's being a Jesus follower. It's modeling Jesus. Jesus is concerned for everyone and truly loving other people, not just saying it, but actually doing for others. So I think it's important for us to have these conversations to get it out. I think that I've had some very interesting conversations with a lot of my friends who have called me that concern. I've talked to some of them, and some of them are white. And I think the overwhelming unawareness that there was an issue is what struck me the most. That for me to explain what I go through on a daily basis that they had no clue about, it's just amazing. I feel bad because I feel like I haven't done my part of being open and honest with them. And like Kevin just said, you just don't talk about the things that happen to you every day.
Ryan, I'm watching your face, and I think that you're reflecting back to us the feelings that a lot of white people are going to hear having sat with what Preston just said. So can you share with me what's going on for you right now?
Yeah, I started out really excited, and now I'm just kind of really frustrated. You know, Kevin, what you said really spoke to me. I've been a part of the problem. And it's really frustrating to me that I've overlooked and flipped through tweet after tweet after news story and done absolutely nothing. And I feel personally accountable that I will not let that happen again. And I feel personally accountable to have these conversations because I'm still in a lot of conversations with the circles that I'm with. And people don't get it. And I'm just baffled. I'm completely baffled that you can see the facts in front of you and not be moved. But I'm also giving them grace because I wasn't there either. And something triggered this time, and I don't know what it is. But it's a different experience this time that I refuse to walk away from. And I think some of that, as I mentioned before, that, you know, we do have a Latinx daughter now. And for me to think that one of my daughters will have a completely different experience than the other daughter because of the color of her skin makes me angry. And, you know, that's why I just think having this conversation and keeping the conversation going and being intentional about it is absolutely critical for me, because I know how easy it is for me to take my white privilege and to move on and never look back. And my world could remain very consistent.
Yeah.
But as a Christian and as a believer in God, where all people are equal, I just can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
I'm grateful, Ryan, that you kind of dug in there to some of your heart emotions and shared some of your gut. I think that's really important. Because in the midst of all the emotions, sometimes we want to skate past this stuff because it's uncomfortable.
Would anybody else like to speak to that? Of what does it feel like in this moment to be a person of color? And yeah, Damani, see white people start waking up.
So I married a white girl. And I married a white girl from West Texas. Not only did I marry a white girl from West Texas, I married a white girl from West Texas who grew up in what is statistically the most conservative county in the United States of America. I'm from Brooklyn. So it's been interesting just to walk through this, not just this time, but just to walk through the past almost 9 years. We have two children, so that we have two mixed race children, which is a phrase that I hate, but nevertheless. And my wife talks, Heather talks about the fact that there's a lot that she couldn't have been aware of prior to being married, that there is an awakening that has happened to her. Thankfully, I mean, for her, this awakening has happened over the course of the past several years. But this is awakening that has happened with her realizing the different ways in which people are engaged and different ways in which people are treated. I was talking to her recently and I said, we have a friend who suffers from chronic migraines. And I remember one day I was over at she and her husband's house and they're like a fantastic, like fashionable couple. You would never know when you looked at them that they had any sort of maladies. And so I remember I said to her one day, I said, okay, so chronic migraines, like what's that? What does that mean? Does that mean that you always have a headache? And she said, yeah. And I said, okay. So like, do you have a headache right now? And she paused and like looked up and said, yeah, yeah, I do. That's what racism is like for Black people in America.
Great analogy, man. That's a really good analogy.
Yeah, that is. So for those of you we haven't heard from yet, I want to take a few minutes and just give you the opportunity. Is there something that really resonated with you? Is there something that's coming up for you? So if you haven't had the opportunity to jump in yet, please feel free.
For sure. I guess I'll go. So when Preston talked about how education, he thought education would kind of protect him in a way from dealing with just being different, or in my case, being a brown Latina, that's how I viewed things, you know. In third grade, I remember being made fun of for not being able to speak English very well. And even though, like, in the surface level, it's like normal, in the back of my head, I subconsciously decided to make it a point to sound white and make it a point to strip away from my identity. And I lived my whole life and up until college with that mentality. So when I'm at college and I'm looking around and I'm seeing no one that looks like me, that's when it finally hits me, like, oh, this whole time I've been running away from my identity. And now I'm realizing I'm one of the only people here that look like me. So this whole time I could have been helping, you know, my fellow brothers and sisters. And instead I was like climbing on top of them, trying to strip away from my identity so I can feel accepted, so I don't have to feel that shame. And so that's when I decided to embrace, you know, my identity, embrace my culture. But at the same time, when you start embracing that culture, then you get that backlash of, why are you not proud of who you are as an American? Why are you not proud of being in this country? Why are you calling yourself Mexican American instead of American? And it's like you get it both ways. When you can't be accepted if you're trying to fit in, and then the second you kind of come to your own, you're being told that you don't fit in, like you shouldn't be that person. And it's like exhausting.
I'll jump in. The word that kept sticking out to me is authenticity. I remember early on in a life group at Life in Deep Ellum, as a matter of fact, I think when I came to Life in Deep Ellum, I thought I was searching for God. But I think what I was really, he was pointing me to myself. And I remember we were talking about being authentic and genuine. And I remember when, like, the life group leader was talking about that, I couldn't, like, it didn't sit well with me, because I had spent most of my life building up walls, adapting to the people I was with, the groups I was in, and I was good at it. I could fit in almost anywhere. And even in high school, it's like, oh, you play sports? Me too. Oh, you're in AP classes? Me too. This is so emotional. That's why I was talking about being overwhelmed. I didn't realize how much of myself I hid. Even though I was friends with people, I never felt known by anyone. And as we circle around talking about authenticity, I find myself leaning into my faith so much because my Creator created me. He created my skin, my body, my mind, my spirit. And if He can love me and create me this way and create other people to look the way that we all look different and speak differently, and He can love us so much, I have a hard time not seeing how we can't see each other the same way that God sees us. And sometimes those thoughts overwhelm me. And that's why it's so important to me to be a part of the conversation.
Yeah.
Good.
Shonda. Yeah, I want to go ahead and move into our second question. And the question is, what are you afraid of? What are you afraid of right now? And I'd like to hear first from our community members who are Black, because you guys, it's important for our community to hear you. And what are you afraid of in this moment? And we'll get to what we're hopeful about, but I think we've got to start with, where's the pain right now?
We're excited. Yes, changed. And it's like I want to see what happens when the country legitimately opens back up. Like, yeah. Do we go back to our regular way of not caring about things? Or is this a narrative and a conversation that continues? That's my biggest fear, is that 4 months, people think it's intense. And then 6 months from now, we're not even talking about it.
Yeah, that's real, man. Who else? Who else is willing to share what you're afraid of?
I can. I'll first echo what Damani was saying, that probably before this weekend, that was 100% what I was going to share, is what I was being afraid of, that this was just for a moment, that this conversation, even though difficult and awkward and uncomfortable, was going to come to an end, and people that aren't Black or brown are going to be the only ones left to think about this problem when the time continues. And I'm still afraid of that. But this weekend, I went camping, solo camping, like I've done multiple times. And I had an experience, happened to be camping in Klan country, which I didn't know that I was. Had like a pickup truck drive back and forth past my site multiple times. Had a man, a white man, try to educate me about the dangers of Antifa and why he loves Candace Owens and ask where I was headed next. And on the way home, I was pulled over by a cop who unexpectedly opened up my driver's door. And those were all terrifying. And so I guess the fear that I have is that these conversations are happening within a bubble, and they aren't happening in places that they really need to happen. And it's crazy because I have a friend that's from rural Texas, and she posted something on Facebook, and I went to go like it, like in support and solidarity. And I like read the comments, and she is having completely different conversations on this post of just saying Black Lives Matter than what I would be having on a post of the same thing. And so I guess my fear, along with the conversation ending, is that not everybody's having it. And some of the people arguably that might need to be entering the conversation the most or not?
I have been a teacher for about 15 years. And when Tamir Rice was murdered, I was teaching middle school students. And I think my fear then is the same fear I have now. And that's that the anti-Blackness, the anti-Black racism that we have had, that has been, we're breathing in it, that it's going to follow my kids home when they're walking home from school. My students who have nothing but hope and potential and love and to give, that there is so much rhetoric right now that is a danger to their bodies. So I worry about that all the time as their teacher. I worry about their minds. I worry about their mental health. I worry that we're asking, we ask our Black students and our Latinx students and our students of color and our students whose parents are immigrants, who are immigrants, we ask them to take on so much. And that in the education system, that's where most of our kids experience their first real big up close and personal sting of racism, up close and personal, is in our classrooms.
Lucy, we haven't heard from you yet. Anything you want to contribute at this point?
Yeah, thanks. I'll start with the fear piece, and I think it ties into why I think it's super important to be having these conversations. I'm afraid, I think, like many of you already said, that the moment will pass, we'll get distracted by the next shiny object. Nothing will have changed. And like Sherry was saying, racism can be personal, and it is also structural and institutional. And if we don't deal with the structural and institutional at that level, we're not going to see the impact that we want to see on our communities. And I'm afraid that we won't have the strength to do what's required. And what's required is going to be really digging deep into why things are the way they are and how we have set them up the way they are. The system isn't broken. It's working exactly as it is supposed to be working. And I think that's the piece that is really difficult to wrestle with, because we have to tear down that system. And there are people who benefit from it and structures that benefit from it. And so that's why we need to be having these conversations, why we need to be leaning in, why we can't run away from them.
Yeah.
And then I just wanted to say to Christy and to Deb and to LaShonda, what you shared about always wanting to be, or always striving to be good enough, really, quite honestly, to be white enough, really sat with me, because that is something that I feel like has been part of my life forever, right? And surely in a different way than everybody experiences in a slightly different way. But I feel like as an Asian American, the way that has come out is you're always made to feel as other. You're just always made to feel as other. You're never American enough. And to my Chinese relatives, I'm never Chinese enough either. So what you shared, Christy, really resonated with me. And And then you do everything you're supposed to do. And then as Asians, you're held up as a model minority. And so that's the way white people divide people of color from each other,
mm-hmm.
right? Because why can't you, other person of color, be like them? Not understanding the historical realities and context under which my parents immigrated from Taiwan and Hong Kong. And the immigration laws that have in our country created the way things are.
Well, the question that I want us to come to now is, what's giving you hope? What is giving you hope right now? Deb, you're smiling real big. Do you got one for us?
Yes, I think that being in a faith community such as LIDE brings me hope. And I want to say thank you to you and to Joel for making space for us to talk about these issues. Because looking back at my story in Brazil, I didn't grow up in a society where I felt like my voice mattered. And it's extremely important for me and Jeremy to be part of a place where we feel as a family, where we feel like our voice matter. Our voice matters. And but I also think that we need to be more intentional as a faith community. And I think Sherry was talking about children, her students. And I think that we need to think about our children and be role models by expanding our circle of friends, mm-hmm. and just by teaching our children just polite ways of asking their friends questions, instead of saying things like, what are you, when they're playing at the playground, or, you know, where are you from? We need to teach our kids to be more compassionate and ask questions such as, oh, tell me about your family. Where did you grow up? And things like that. I think everything goes back to our house, how we are exposing ourselves to the reality of our world, and not just the black and white issue that we are seeing here in the U.S. But like I said, it's larger than just here. You know, racism is a big issue in Brazil, and what a lot of people don't know is that the Portuguese colonists took about 4 million enslaved Africans to Brazil. And then we have the same systemic racism in Brazil. But we also have the same issues in Haiti, in Cuba, and everywhere you see black and brown people as well. We are faced with the same issues. And we have to talk about those things with our kids. We need to talk about different cultures, how to accept people who have an accent, right? And I really appreciate what Christy was talking about this whole thing about identity. And I've been unpacking a ton of that lately. And like some of you guys has said, that this time it feels different. And I have to be honest that for the first time, I'm really like speaking up a little more, because like I said, as a black and an immigrant, sometimes I feel like I don't have this, like, a space to talk about these things. I don't have a voice. I don't have value. And I'm being completely honest, even though I have an education, you know, I have a family, I have a husband who loves me. I grew up in a good family. But it's still a struggle. Still a struggle to feel like I belong, to feel like, you know, my voice matters. So I am thankful, and I have joy and a lot of hope, because Life in the Ellen and it's, you know, is offering spaces like this for us to talk about these issues. And yeah, that's what I'm hopeful.
I'm very hopeful of the diversity of the coalition that is been forming. When I went for the first time in my life to walk in downtown Dallas in one of the protests, and I saw my across from the place where I work, saying some of my Latin friends with mi lucha es tu lucha, tu lucha es mi lucha, signs saying your fight is my fight. When I saw young white friends there, when I saw all the diversity coming together and in a very intentional way, challenging the system that we have, that was very helpful to see.
Kevin, how about you? What's given you some hope?
Well, there's a lot of things, you know. One of the things is having people like Preston that reached out to me and say, are you willing to have this conversation? Because honestly, I thought about doing it, but it was kind of awkward and it wasn't something that I would bring up. Maybe I wouldn't even ask. It was easier to put it aside. But when Preston said, are you willing to do this? I'm like, yes, yes. Thank you for asking. It gives me hope that he feels like he could reach out to me, you know. And another thing that gives me hope is I feel like I can ask my friends of color questions that they might think are stupid or ignorant, but they're willing to share with me and give me answers to things that I don't know about. Coming from where I am, a place of white privilege, I don't always know. I don't understand what they've been through. So that gives me hope. And then, you know, something that gives me hope too is maybe just somehow we're all going to change a little bit. You know, and I don't have a big sphere of influence, but I have a few people I know. I can have conversations with people. I can open up about what I'm feeling. We can talk about it. And hopefully somehow it changes this world a little bit, that when my grandkids grow up, they're not facing these same issues, that life is a little bit better.
I'd like to jump in and say also thank you. I'm hopeful, and I always hesitate because I don't want to sound too preachy and too spiritual about things, but I truly believe that's where all our power and thought processes and actions come from. I think our spirits are truly changed when we accept Jesus Christ. And God is so benign, so loving, so understanding that he allows us to choose what we want to think and what we want to do. Even though he's in us, and he takes our souls and changes it, we have to intentionally try to understand what he's done and let that soulful change affect how we think and what we do. And so to me, the thing that gives me hope this time is that this is the first time in my lifetime I've seen so many hearts touched at the same time. Mm-hmm. So I think if we lean in and listen to our spirits, the outcry of God telling us this is wrong and we got to fix it, it will empower us mentally to change and go on toward our actions to know we have to do something. And I told Rachel in an email, I said that her generation, and I'm aging you younger than I am, Rachel, you're in that mid group of people that I think make a change in our country. Because the young people are the protesters. They're going to get out there and they're going to fight for change, but they don't have the means yet. The people that are in that 30 to 50 age group, they're the ones that have the means to make changes. They're the legislators. They're the ones that can affect changing how things are done, fix this system. Like Lo said, the system works exactly as it's supposed to be working. You know, it's not broken. We need to break it. And it's going to take that group of people, my friends and our age group, those of us that are aware, we're going to be supportive and help and actually do some changing. And I look at my white friends in that age group and know that they're truly trying to understand and adapt to what we're going through and be sympathetic and empathetic to it. But it's going to really take some legislative change in our country to fix what's going on. And that's going to have to come from a heart of change. And so that's what I'm hopeful for. I'm most hopeful for the idea that this time God is crying out so loudly that a lot more people are hearing it. And they're compelled, like Ryan said, you're compelled to do something different. You cannot stay the same. You cannot stay the same. You cannot continue to let it exist. And so, I mean, I think you can tell from all of us this how emotional all this is. But that's because it's deep within us. It's a spiritual movement that's going on.
Sitting in that room, that virtual room with our community members was so holy. And I am so glad that we were able to share that conversation with you this morning. And whatever feelings are rising in you now, I encourage you to sit with those, to share those with other members of your community today. I love what Preston said. He said, "This is just the beginning. This is just the beginning." You know, maybe you've seen the meme where you have the person on the street corner that's holding the sign that says, "This is the end." And then you have someone around the corner with the Black Lives Matter sign and the little bubble saying, "This is just the beginning." And it is. Preston was right. The civil rights movement was not something that happened over the matter of days or weeks or months. It was years and years of people and the church showing up and enacting their prayers, enacting the kind of kingdom, what it means when we say, "Lord, may your kingdom come. Your will be done on earth as it is in heaven." And that's what this moment is about. Just going, we want none of the hell of racism. We want to bring people into this heaven, heaven coming to earth. But it's the beginning. And beginnings are awkward. For the first several weeks after we began the digital services, after every time I preached, I would go to my office and I would cry. Because it was so uncomfortable for me, and I felt so vulnerable and so awkward and so not good at this. I mean, when I tried to preach, my eyes went every which way. You know that. You saw it. Brené Brown calls these effing first times. Terrible first times. It's just hard to start new things. Especially as adults. As children, you know, we kind of have to. We have to learn new things in order to grow. But as adults, we find our lane, the place that we're experts. We get really good at things. Our knowledge base is wide and deep in certain areas. And so we kind of tend to stay in that space. But right now, a lot of us are being invited into a space that we've never been before, into conversations we've never had before. And it is vulnerable and awkward and uncomfortable, and none of us want to do things that we're not good at. But maybe one of those unpleasant truths is America is not good. Americans are not good at having open, vulnerable conversations on race. And we weren't good at it in the beginning of our country, and we have never been good at it. But it is time for us to grow in this. We have to know what the truth is so that we can know how to respond to it. Jesus is calling us to hear, to listen, to engage these conversations with great courage. This week, I read a book by Pia Melody called The Intimacy Factor. And in it, she writes, "Most of us who have problems with relationships maintain our dysfunctional normality by viewing incoming emotion and thought as hostile and respond either by going silent or turning aggressive. In either case, we seek to become invulnerable. And becoming invulnerable, we step outside of relationships and make intimacy impossible." As I read that, I thought she could have just as easily written, "Those of us who have problems with racism, America, those of us who have problems with racism maintain our dysfunctional normality by viewing incoming emotion and thought as hostile and respond either by going silent or turning aggressive. In either case, we seek to become invulnerable, and becoming invulnerable, we step outside of relationships and make anti-racism and healing impossible. Friends, we have a choice. We can be vulnerable or we can be invulnerable. We can be anti-racist or we can be racist. And what I want you to hear me say this morning is you can do it. You can be vulnerable. You can be anti-racist. You can be Christian. That's what our faith requires of us. So let's not maintain the status quo, the dysfunctional normality by going invulnerable in this time. Instead, let's follow the example that we saw displayed by our community members so beautifully this morning. Let's follow the example of Jesus, who showed us what it means to love well, to show up vulnerably in relationships, to stand in solidarity with those the world sees as the least of these. That's how Jesus showed up. And you can do it too. You can be vulnerable. So let me pray for you this morning. Lord, bless us. Bless us with courage. Bless us with endurance. Bless us with vulnerable and open hearts. May holy desires rise in us. May it become clear to us, to each of us, what is ours to own and to do in this time. May we find grace and hope. And I ask this in Jesus' name. Friends, I love you so much. I miss you so much. Oh, please don't forget about July 15th. We will look forward to being with all of you at our gathering Zoom. I am so looking forward to seeing your beautiful faces there. So let me just give you our benediction. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May he make his face to shine on you. May he be gracious and compassionate to you and give you peace. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and all God's people say, amen. Friends, on this holiday weekend, July 4th, the celebration of the independence of our country, we couldn't think of a better conversation to have with you than this one. So thank you for being a part. We'll see you soon.